comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Tell you, there's nothing quite like having a little video mix-up right at the beginning. Oh, welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on earth. Whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very first time tonight. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. I hope you make a habit out of it. It's a good habit to get into, an excellent habit to get into, as a matter of fact. I'm here because it matters, and so do you. The K-Files e-zine. I've gotten a couple of emails from folks who didn't listen to the show, and then I've gotten several from people who did listen to the show on Friday. On Friday, I said that the K-Files e-zine would be delayed. It got shoved completely off the map. And it just didn't happen this last week. There was no K-Files e-zine. And the reason for that was when the computer crashed last weekend, a week ago, I had to install new hardware, and then I had to reinstall all the software, and then I had to, and that included finding all the drivers for the new was not new hardware, it's just spare hardware. Had to find all the drivers and install those. And then I had to install, run the backups on there. And we had something coming up on this Saturday that I was trying to get ready for. What was coming up was the Gods in the Garden seminar that we did. And so everything that would have been done last Sunday didn't get done until Monday late or Tuesday. Everything that should have been done Monday didn't get done till Tuesday late or Wednesday, and so it rippled all the way through the week. And so we just, in order to get done everything that had to be done in order for us to put on that Gods in the Garden seminar, and it's not just dropping a DVD into a player and playing it. There was a lot of editing that had to be done. But anyway, in order to get all that done, the K-Files e-zine suffered. It was a casualty last week. The survival meter, if you're looking at it, there's reason to cheer. We are almost where we have to be. We're within $80. So that's close. That's very, very close. And I want to thank everyone who has donated, everyone who paid to attend the Gods in the Garden seminar, and everything that you did, everything, all the people who joined and the people who are already members and just everything you've done to make this happen for another month, thank you. I appreciate it, and it looks like we're going to be okay for another 30 days. And then it all starts over again, you know, on October the 1st. But I want to thank everyone who has donated and everyone who yet will donate within the next couple of days. Thank you so much. And you just have to know from my heart, I do truly appreciate it. My guest tonight is Dr. Michael Sala. And this ought to be, because it always is when he's with us, very compelling. We'll be back right after this. Hey, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Michael Sala, truly one of the pioneers and a leading voice in the exopolitics movement. He's the director of exopolitics.org. Dr. Sala, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Aloha, Kevin. I'm glad to be back.
Dr. Sala, I want to jump right off into the deep end here. You know, exopolitics deals with so many things, but basically I guess we could say how to interface properly with extraterrestrial civilizations. And for years we've been hearing rumors that there are possibly some alien bases of some type on the moon. And you and I have talked about that in previous shows. Well, lately there have been little twinklings, little things happening that just sort of give a little twinkle in that direction, that seem to sort of point that direction. And I wonder if you could sort of update us a little bit on what do you know, what information do you have about the possibility that there are alien bases on the moon?
Well, Kevin, there are a number of sources that really do help us understand what is up there on the moon. There are, of course, the images taken by various lunar missions that have been placed up there that show all kinds of anomalies. I think it was Fred Steckling and George Leonard who wrote two of the first books that talked about the artificial structures on the moon. Then we had that really curious incident with Ingo Swann, where he was actually contracted by a CIA operative to do some remote viewing on the moon, and basically they got him to spy on what appeared to be an extraterrestrial base on the moon, where he saw some naked extraterrestrials. And that was something that Ingo Swann talked about, and he got well paid for it, so this was no kind of laughing matter. This was a serious project that was under the auspices of a covert branch of the CIA. And curiously enough, he later got confirmation for what he saw in terms of a book by George Leonard that the CIA operative said, well, that the CIA operative basically forwarded to him as confirmation that, yes, this is what's up there. So I don't think really that there's any doubt that we are looking at the moon as a place that in its history has had bases constructed by extraterrestrials, and that in the present era some of these bases are probably being used by certain extraterrestrials, and that these are of great interest by various government agencies. And of course that raises the whole question about the La Crosse mission, which I think it's October 22nd, that it is going to basically plunge into the moon after having done some reconnaissance in an effort to identify if there is water particles in one of the moon's poles. So that has gotten people talking, and I think we might look at that as maybe being a mission that has something other than a purely scientific objective.
Okay. Now, see, this... I'm glad you brought that up, La Crosse, because the next thing I want to talk about related to the moon is something that just happened back on August 30th. And it's a story that has been very quickly buried. The Indian, I think it's called the Indian Space Research Organization, that's their version of NASA, had a satellite, the Chandrayaan-1, in orbit around the moon. And the Chandrayaan-1 on August the 30th, encountered difficulties. All right, now, the first report that came out about that quoted a Mr. Satish, who is a spokesperson for the ISRO. And he said that at on a certain date, at a certain time, it just, and this is a quote, vanished from radar. I mentioned that on this show, and I've talked about it several times. Very quickly, within just 2 or 3 days, that article disappeared from the internet. A new article appeared as an update written by the same guy, and instead of saying it disappeared off of radar, it said they lost radio contact with it. Now, there's a big, huge difference there. If a 747 is flying across the sky and its radio goes down, they don't disappear from radar. There's still a blip on the radar screen. If a 747 is flying across the country and a UFO flies over it and a light beam hits it and the 747 vanishes, then it disappears off of radar. If the 747 crashes, it disappears off of radar. But it doesn't disappear just because they lose radio contact. Now, some people don't really see the significance here. The significance is, in one case, you have radio failure. In the other case, the satellite disappeared. Just vanished. Okay, now, if we go back to the early part of this year, the last part of last year and the early part of this year, what we had, I believe in November of last year, what we had was the Mars Global Surveyor in orbit around Mars. And the Mars Global Surveyor disappeared. They didn't just lose radio contact. It went around behind Mars, and when it was supposed to emerge and reestablish contact, it didn't. They assumed it was some sort of telemetry problem, radio problem. And so they moved the new satellite into position, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and it has what they call the high-rise or the high-resolution camera. And they turned that camera toward where the Mars Global Surveyor should be. And they wanted to see what sort of damage it had suffered. And maybe there was some workaround. Well, it wasn't there. And not only was it not there, there was no debris. There was no debris field. And there was no satellite. It just vanished. All right, now we're back to the moon and the Chandrayaan-1. It's going around the moon. It has just confirmed that there is water on the moon. And bingo, it disappears from radar, according to Mr. Satish in the first report. Do you think, and see, I think this is a matter for exopolitics. Do you think that maybe we're doing something that's ticking off these extraterrestrials and they're picking off the satellite that's ticking them off?
Well, I think we need to acknowledge firstly that there is a secret space fleet, a covert space fleet that is capable of doing deep space missions, that this has been in operation for several decades now. A number of people have talked about it, whistleblowers have come forward to talk about it. And so this space fleet is able to deploy to do various things. And I think when we're talking about, you know, bases on the moon, bases on Mars, we need to consider the possibility that some of these bases are occupied by covert government projects, that these are facilities that are not known to NASA, and that so when you have satellites such as Chandrayaan-1 kind of in orbit around the moon, you know, taking a look at many things, they may reach a point where they decide that they want to take that out because it may be interfering with their mission objectives. It may be that this scheduled detonation of La Crosse, or the La Crosse plunging into one of the poles, that they don't want to have an Indian satellite lunar orbiter kind of monitoring what's happening there at the time, because, you know, one of the theories, or one of the things that I've heard, and I haven't been able to confirm this, but I've got this from two sources, is that that indeed that there are some artificial structures at the location where La Crosse is going to be detonating, is going to be impacting, and the mission objective is not a scientific one, but is in fact a military one. It's like they don't want the Indians and the Chinese to eventually land on the moon and find all of these ancient extraterrestrial artifacts. That basically, it looks like they're beginning a process of blowing them up. That is one of the explanations I've heard, and that kind of makes a lot of sense to me given the capabilities of the secret space fleet.
Well, I've heard that, and the scenario hangs together logically, except given the capabilities of the secret space fleet, I don't see why there would be an impact even necessary. Provided that secret space fleet is what we've been told, what all the rumors say, they have technology where they could just hover above the thing, turn on some type of a pulsed energy weapon, and no impact, just incinerate everything, reduce it to dust.
Well, that's a good point. It may be that, like any facility or any set of assets possessed by any government military organization, there may be only a limited number of craft to perform missions, and if you have other means of being able to achieve your mission objectives, then you take advantage of that. So from a kind of cost-benefit analysis, it may be that a decision was made that the most effective way of kind of dealing with this particular issue might be to deploy something like the La Crosse mission and disguise it as a purely scientific mission.
There is another possibility. Another possibility, certainly not the only other possibility, but another possibility is La Crosse happens, but it happens as a cover, so we're all looking there instead of looking at something else that might be happening elsewhere on the moon.
Well, yes, that's another good possibility there. I think the way in which the secret government operates is that they rarely have a single objective, that they try to do things that achieve a number of objectives simultaneously. And I think it may well be that on the one hand, they might want to remove whatever they don't want the Indians and the Chinese to see up there, while at the same time, they want to create a misdirection from something else. So, you know, that's possible.
Yeah, it could be many, many layers of things. But now, here is an interesting twist. NASA has now, basically because the Indians reported it, NASA had to go along and report it too. And that is, they found this Chandrayaan-1 found that there is water on the moon, and they got spectral photographs showing the water and its movement throughout the day, and it's pretty much all over the moon. But we're not talking about streams and rivers, but we're talking about H2O residing in the soil. Okay? At the same time, almost at the same time, NASA has announced they found ice on the moon. Now, the stated reason, at least it's my understanding, that the stated reason for La Crosse is they're going to crash this hunk of junk into the a crater at the South Pole and then do spectral analysis of the ejecta as it comes out to look for water. If you found ice and the Indians found that there is H2O in the soil, what would be the justification for continuing then with La Crosse when its stated objective, at least my understanding of it, is to look for water?
Well, that's a good point. If the Indians made that announcement, and I haven't read it, so I can't really comment too much on what you just said about their announcement, but I mean, I'm assuming that they did. Well, yeah, I think it undercuts the rationale for the for much of the La Crosse mission in terms of that impact, that there is water there on the moon. It's been discovered through spectral analysis, as you said, and so why the mission?
One of my regular listeners sent me an interesting email. And his email said, you know, NASA says they brought all these rocks back from the moon soil and moon rocks, and they brought it all back. They've had that all this time, and with all of the experiments and all the science that they've done with these objects from the moon, they did not discover H2O? Pretty good point.
Well, as you know, there has been a kind of long, drawn-out process by which NASA has kind of really made it difficult for the scientific community to establish that there are life-bearing conditions on planets such as Mars and the Moon. And so there's been this kind of long process by which the discovery of things such as water took quite an extensive period of time to just be accepted as viable.
We have to step away for a break, Doctor. We'll be back, folks, right after this break. Don't go away. More deep stuff coming up, I promise. Welcome back. My guest this evening, Dr. Michael Sala. Dr. Sala, we were talking about that NASA makes it difficult for the scientists to prove that conditions for life exist on other planets. But let me pose a different idea here. Almost all scientists are evolutionists. Not all of them, but almost all of them are evolutionists. And they say life happens where the conditions for life exist. I think that statement is too long. I think the reality is life happens. Because here's the deal. The life that we see on this planet, if evolution is true, the life that we see on this planet evolved using the building blocks that were here on this planet. But that doesn't mean it's the only way life can evolve. So you go over to Titan, where you've got a whole bunch of methane. If evolution is true, then life happens on Titan based on methane rather than oxygen. And when you get over to Mars, it's if what they tell us is true about the atmosphere, which I seriously doubt, but they say it's about 95% carbon dioxide. Okay, life happens there based on carbon dioxide rather than oxygen. I think life happens, and it happens within the context of wherever it is.
Well, I mean, that's something that scientists have been able to confirm on the Earth in terms of life being able to take place or be created in very inhospitable circumstances, such as in the deep great ocean depths, near volcanic eruptions at high temperatures, in polar regions, so that you have life being able to be created or be sustained in very extreme circumstances. And so I think scientists are very aware of that when it comes to the Earth. But
well, not only that, they have found life on this planet that will die when you expose it to oxygen. It lives in carbon dioxide and hydrocarbons. And it's very, very ancient. They call it archaea, something similar to a bacteria, but it does not survive once you expose it to oxygen. And that's right here on this planet. Now, if that happens here, happens at great depths, by the way. You have to dig down to it. But if it happens here, why would we suspect it would not happen on Mars, Titan, Venus, Saturn, Mercury? I think life is all around us, but the problem is we're going to the auto parts store to buy bread. And when we don't find bread, we say, well, it's not a store. We're going to these planets where they don't have, the planet does not have the same environmental context. But we look for life that was developed in this context. When we don't find it, they say, well, there's no life there. And I think that's nuts.
Well, I think part of the problem is that a lot of the NASA missions are not designed to find life. They're designed to find life-bearing conditions. And there is an important difference between the two. And, for example, in that very famous incident in 1976 with the Viking lander, where one of the scientists announced that based on the data that they had, that it looked like they had discovered life. But because the Viking mission was set up to do experiments determining whether life-bearing conditions existed, part of the experiment involved basically burning what may have been some evidence of life, because they were seeking evidence of life-bearing conditions. So and so that's a very clever way in which NASA can send up these very expensive missions and just kind of like delay the day when there eventually will be an acknowledgement of extraterrestrial life, because they're kind of doing these really convoluted scientific experiments to prove whether or not life-bearing conditions exist. But yet the data that has been accumulated over many decades from many different sources really does point to the answer to the question of, you know, is there life on planets such as Mars, or life in the past on the Moon. I mean, that's pretty clear that there was, but NASA is going to keep us kind of guessing with these missions that come up with more complex experiments for determining whether life-bearing conditions exist.
Well, yeah, I think they're playing to the public, really, because most of the public never even considers what I just said about, you know, if evolution is true, then it would happen with whatever elements are available. And now, we would not evolve on Mars. We would not evolve on Saturn, but something could. But most people never consider that possibility. When you think about life, they think they picture things. Most people, when they think in pictures. So if you say alien, they think little green man because they've been programmed by the media to think that way. If you say UFO, they automatically think flying saucer because and extraterrestrial because that's the way they've been programmed. And they picture this in their minds. And so they think in pictures. It's like a bunch of adults with coloring books. And they just try to color inside the lines. They don't think outside the lines. But with exopolitics, you have to think outside the lines. Did you go to the conference that was held recently in Barcelona?
Yes, I was there.
All right. Richard Hoagland was there, and he spoke about and showed photographs of a gigantic structure in the rings of Saturn. Now, this gigantic structure in the rings of Saturn, folks, if you watch the video, he will show you why that appears to be artificial. And it's huge. It is gigantic. Is it possible, Dr. Sala, that that structure is inhabited by extraterrestrials? Now, he showed one picture where it looked like there was a craft hovering, a very large craft, hovering just above the ring. And, you know, he kind of intimated that maybe, you know, it was extraterrestrials sort of saying, hey, folks, we're here, and you don't need to be messing around over here. All right, do you think that that structure is a structure, and do you think that it is possibly inhabited currently?
Well, I know of the structure that you're talking about. Richard Hoagland presented his at Leeds in England, not in Barcelona, Spain.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I thought he did that in Spain.
Yes, no, it was in Leeds, England. But
okay.
Nevertheless, I've seen images of that kind of vertical structure popping out of one of the rings, out of the rings of Saturn. And well, you know, there are all of these anomalies that Richard Hoagland has been able to find using some of the NASA imagery, whether it's on Mars, the Moon. Whether it's on one of the moons of Saturn, the Iapetus, and of course the rings of Saturn now, that, you know, there are all of these anomalies, and what is the explanation for those? Richard, I think, really does try to open up the possibility that the artificial nature of these structures can only lead to the conclusion that it is an extraterrestrial created object, and certainly that's something that I think we all need to look at. One of the things that I think, you know, which kind of raises the whole exopolitics perspective is that, you know, you do have these deep space missions that come up with a lot of very interesting data, images that are very suggestive of artificial structures and advanced extraterrestrial life forms flying in deep space. And we have whistleblowers that have come forward and said that, you know, they were a party or saw how many of these images were being scrubbed. Donna Hare, Sergeant Carl Wolf have talked about their experiences at the Disclosure Project where they saw this happening. So, you know, what we have, you know, given on the one hand, people like Richard Hoagland doing the analysis of these images, finding artificial structures or these very interesting anomalies. We have the testimonies of people like Carl Wolf and Donna Hare pointing to NASA or certain national security agencies scrubbing these images clean of this kind of data, that the conclusion is that, yes, there's a lot of life out there, and the public is kind of like being deceived over exactly what is out there.
Well, and it's interesting you bring that up, because that was my next question. And that is, you know, we've been talking about the existence of aliens, extraterrestrials, living on the moon, the possibility of them being on Mars. And then I asked the question about Saturn's rings. And the next question is, how crowded is our neighborhood? How populous is this solar system? Look, it's easy for us to think, well, you know, the universe is huge. There's got to be some other guys out there somewhere. Okay, let's get into our neighborhood. How populated is our solar system?
Well, there's a couple of ways of answering that question. One is looking at whistleblower testimonies of extraterrestrials that are known or who have been interacting with humans. So we've got people like Clifford Stone talking about 57 different races that were catalogued by 1991. Then there are other whistleblowers who talk about what is being captured by the deep space imaging satellite systems. And I know one person contacted me, a female who requested anonymity at the time, and she told me what had happened, that in doing this deep space satellite imaging, and that was her job for a branch of the military, I believe it was the Air Force, she basically saw some really interesting objects, and then took the data home with her along with a colleague to discuss it, and they came up with the conclusion that these were ships, that they were basically tracking in deep space, these ships coming into the solar system, and that this was something that was happening on a regular basis. So I think that, you know, based on that, we can conclude that yes, there's a lot of activity in deep space.
All right, Dr. Sala, we have to step away for a break again, and folks, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back. Dr. Sala, when we went away for break, and we were discussing this question, just how populated is this solar system, and you were telling us about someone who told you about seeing images of spaceships coming in far out in our solar system, but deep space, but coming entering our solar system. What conclusions did she draw from this?
That this was something that they were monitoring, but that it was something that they weren't allowed to talk about, especially to one another. It was basically just data collection, that was her job, that the analysis was being done by others, and once the data had been passed on, whatever was left had to be destroyed. And I believe that's what she took home with her, some of the data that was supposed to be destroyed, and eventually she decided for her own kind of security that she would be better off destroying it herself rather than being caught with it.
All right.
But now, the data did point to that phenomenon of what appeared to be ships traveling into the solar system and being monitored.
Well, in 2004, the United States Air Force published a document that was called Flight Plan Transformation something. I can't remember the name of it. But it was 2004, and in there, one of the things they said had to be built and deployed by 2010 was the space-based space surveillance system. And Leonard David, who writes for space.com, wrote an article about it in which he said his comment on that was that this is a system, a space-based system, looking out into space, into deep space, and it's an optical system looking out into deep space for the purpose of identifying and tracking deep space forces. I found that to be very interesting, and I asked the question, okay, so who's out in deep space? And perhaps you've just given us the answer. And perhaps that's the system from which she got her data, because it's an optical system. And as of the end of last year, early this year, they were still building these satellites to put out there. And I put a picture. I got a picture off of the internet of some of the workers that were working on that satellite, and it was taken in 2009, and I put that up on the screen on our TV channel, so people have seen it. So and we all discussed, you know, is this thing out there? Is this for real? Is it out there? And now here's a lady who says she has seen what looks like ships coming in from deep space. Well, she would have had to have a system like that in order to see it.
Right. Well, this happened about 3 years ago that I spoke with her, so it would have been a pre-existing system to the one you've just announced. But nevertheless, it shows that monitoring a deep space is very serious business.
Well, yeah, and listen, they started launching this system. You know, they launch it one satellite at a time, and they started launching it in 2006. So it may be this system. However, this certainly would not be the first system we had looking out into deep space. All right, now, let's talk about exopolitics and as it relates to some of this stuff that we're discussing here tonight. It seems to me that you're saying that the indications are that our solar system is rather populated. It's not just us. It's rather populated. And we have spaceships that are coming in from deep space into our solar system, so the population's growing. We have a couple of satellites that simply vanished. One of them belonged to NASA. One of them belonged to the Indian Space Research Organization. They just vanished. And we're not talking about they just lost radio control. They visibly, optically vanished. It would seem to me that those are indications that we're rubbing someone the wrong way. Now, I understand you said it could be that it's our own space program, secret space program, that may have taken out the Indian satellite. That's a possibility, because they didn't want it to be able to see certain things. However, I don't see, the thing was supposed it had a 365-day mission. It made it 312 days, and it was right after they confirmed the presence of water on the moon that it disappeared.
Well, to me, that's very suspicious. just the timing that the Indians were releasing this data, that was one challenging the legitimacy or the rationale for the La Crosse mission. It was kind of making NASA, it was making it a little too obvious that what NASA was doing was kind of ridiculous. If
Yeah, but you know what makes this even more confusing? The piece of equipment on the Indian satellite that discovered the water was built by NASA. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was... I don't know. It is very confusing.
Well, we need to kind of separate NASA from the secret space program. I mean, NASA, as far as most of the people involved in NASA are concerned, is performing these scientific missions using this kind of open source technology. And as far as they know, they're kind of quite transparent. It's a kind of public agency, and now they would have certain mission objectives, and that's what they think the real objectives are. But there would be a secret space program also in operation, which has people in place through the NASA hierarchy that would be doing various things to make sure that NASA's missions kind of are consistent with what the secret space program is. So you could have this quite easily. You could have this inconsistency where, on the one hand, you have NASA instruments on the Chandrayaan mission basically announcing the discovery of significant quantities of water on the moon, and on the other hand, you have NASA performing a mission which is ostensibly based on trying to discover whether there's water on the moon by arranging for an impact of the La Crosse. And so you could have these kind of what appears to be something in conflict, but I think it's because, you know, the people behind these various projects are not necessarily aware of what the other is doing, and the secret space program has its own objectives, and they probably at a certain point felt that what the Indians were doing was kind of pushing the envelope a little too far, and probably may have decided to just take out the satellite.
Okay. So you don't think you don't think then we're only about a minute now from our next break, but you don't think that there's indication that we're ticking off any extraterrestrial civilizations?
I don't think it would be the Indians that would be doing it. I think it would be probably the secret space fleet or.
No, but I'm saying you don't see in what we're discussing here any indication that we're ticking off extraterrestrials.
I think that is happening. I think that is happening at a certain level, definitely. But I don't think we would include the Indian Space Research Organization.
Oh, I see.
That.
I see what you're saying. Okay, we have to step away here for a break in just a few seconds, 10 seconds or so. When we come back, I have one more big question to ask Dr. Sala, and then I'm going to open the telephone lines for you. So get your fingers warmed up and ready to dial. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Dr. Michael Sala. For those of you who are just now joining us in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. Dr. Sala, when we went away, I said I have one more big question for you. Because you've talked with us quite a bit about this secret space program, and I've read on several websites that it has a name, and they call it Solar Warden. First, I want to know if you've been able to confirm that, and secondly, what is it? What is it up to?
Well, the space, secret space program, the code name for that, as far as I can tell, Solar Warden is fairly accurate. When I have mentioned that to a few sources, they... I mean, it was first mentioned on the Open Minds Forum by a group calling itself the TC Group. And then there was on Project Camelot, Henry Deegan, that also said that the Solar Warden term was accurate. And when I mentioned it to two sources that I have, two Navy sources, they confirmed that, yes, it's real.
Okay, so now what is it comprised of? What is it?
Well, it's a secret space fleet comprising anti-gravity vehicles that are large enough to have a mothership or a large aircraft carrier-sized ship with a number of smaller craft that would act as kind of shuttles or fighter planes. So kind of like an aircraft carrier in space. And that this is something that I believe Gary McKinnon was able to compromise when he hacked into various NASA computers back in 2002. It's worth pointing out that when McKinnon did that and came up with his descriptions of fleet-to-fleet transfers and the names of various non-terrestrial officers and ships, that was in March 2002, and what was interesting was that by November of that year, 2002, Space Command was abolished, that it ceased to be one of the 10 unified commands in the U.S. military system and became a subordinate command within Strategic Command, which is curious timing, and I think that was probably done because McKinnon actually did compromise the security of the secret space fleet, and they were kind of burying it deeper within the kind of convoluted nature of the integrated command system within the U.S. military.
Okay, I want to open up the telephone line so that our audience can call in. And the telephone numbers, for those who are watching on our TV channel, the telephone numbers are on the screen. For those of you who are listening via internet radio or AM, FM, shortwave, or cell phone, the telephone numbers are 623-444-5889. If you need to call me toll-free, we do have a toll-free number, and it is 888-223-4599. As always, if you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada and you don't want to make an international long-distance call, you can if you want to. That number, 623-444-5889, will work from anywhere in the world. You can call that number. It'll work. But if you don't want to make the international telephone call, you can send me a flash message, and you do that by going to my website, which is kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down the page, and you'll see the link. It says flash message. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, Kevin. That's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi, Doctor. I was wondering, it's kind of baffling, they say they can keep secrets, but with, there's a lot of smart people out there with a lot of technology besides the government. And, and to be able to hide something of this magnitude, kind of gives me wonder. You believe it's actually happening?
I think that secrecy is something that is very easily maintained when national security is invoked, especially at an official level. If we're talking about the media, we're talking about Congress, as soon as national security is raised, you find that the media and Congress go the other way, and that whistleblowers who come up and talk about things that are occurring within the national security system are given no protection from retaliation. They have no way of being able to maintain their careers if they do reveal things, and they are subsequently discredited. And so I think it's pretty easy to keep a secret if you invoke national security.
Yeah, how about just like individual people, you know, say like me with a, you know, with one heck of a telescope and, you know, and all kinds of radio equipment and stuff like that. What would keep me quiet? Why wouldn't I go out on the internet and say, hey, you know, this is going on?
Well, Ed Grimsley does that. Ed Grimsley has seen and has subsequently shown to thousands of people through night vision goggles spacecraft flying around above the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that. And so you're right about that. They can't, unless those spaceships had some sort of cloaking device, there's no way to keep that a secret with the technology that's available to people.
Terry Hansen talks about that in his book Missing Times, and I think he kind of made a very good observation that secrecy doesn't mean maintaining a kind of a comprehensive clampdown on any of this information getting out. Basically, secrecy is maintained by ensuring that the national media, the news wires, that they don't run with any of this stuff. So if you have local newspapers running stories about, you know, a strange incident involving a crash with an object that kind of plummeted to Earth, and then mysterious military vehicles came in and cordoned off the area, swore people to secrecy, you know, local news services could kind of run stories like that. But if the national media doesn't pick it up, it's quickly forgotten, and that's the way the secrecy is kept.
Could you just elaborate on, you know, where they're going with this? What's the purpose? And do they have humanity in mind at all in what they're doing? And I'll take the rest offline. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for those questions, Terry. I think what the people who have been dealing with the whole ET UFO issue for decades now, what they have in mind is a kind of pretty warped idea of national security. I think many of them will kind of like say that they're patriots and that they stand for national security, but it's a kind of very convoluted form of national security where a kind of secret committee is the one that determines policy and has policy implemented kind of in a very secretive way where no one really knows exactly who's responsible for whom, but it's always assumed that someone is kind of thinking things through and that there's these draconian security procedures in place to maintain discipline. And I think this is the way in which the system has been set up. And it's done in a way that serves the interests of a very few who kind of like have a very warped idea of what national security is all about. And for the rest of the society, people are kind of left in the dark or groping to understand exactly what's going on. And that even goes for very senior military people or very senior political people, that they're trying to understand what's going on. So in answer as to whether it's in our best interest, I don't believe it is, because ultimately it comes down to what I believe it was President Eisenhower said, you know, when he felt that he had lost control of the situation. He said that the best minds were no longer working on this.
All right, we have a flash message here from John in the United Kingdom, and it says, is there a secret program to promote another type of consciousness for this space fleet? Some of your guests have explained 2012 as being a complete change in terms of consciousness. I guess you cannot drive these craft the same way as a car. All these changes since the 1960s, meditation, remote viewing, yoga, etc., etc., etc. So I think what he's asking, and you may take it differently, but I think what he's asking, Dr. Sala, is do the the military people that are assigned to this secret space fleet, do they undergo training, and have they undergone training in terms of changing, altering their consciousness?
Well, that is a really fascinating question. I think there are a number of processes that probably happen here. One is some process whereby people's mental abilities are enhanced in some way. So there's some kind of mind enhancement program where, like, a person's IQ will jump up from 160, whatever it is that they began with, up to like 190, 200, and so forth. There was a Colonel Steve Wilson who came out in the a few years ago, just very briefly, really, because he died soon after he came forward and began to reveal what he was doing, that he was involved in these crash retrieval operations. But he talked about going through some kind of mind enhancement or mental enhancement program where his IQ kind of jumped off the roof. Similarly, this other whistleblower, Michael Wolfe, who I know is quite controversial, but nevertheless, he also talked about going through some mind enhancement program. So that's one thing that I think is probably happening.
Mm-hmm.
There is some mental enhanced program or technology in place to improve the capabilities of people involved in these secret space programs. Another are these super soldier training programs, which use kind of trauma-based mind control training, where people at a very early age are identified as being gifted and then put through these programs where those gifts are enhanced, but it's done through kind of a compartmentalized process where people's minds are divided up through these mind control programs where they might not necessarily know what capabilities they truly have. And some of these people are deployed on these space missions as fighters, as astronauts, as you know, Stargate jumpers, if you like, whatever the special skills are, people can be identified. Those skills can be developed through these trauma-based mind control mechanisms that apparently are very, very effective.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Yeah, Bob.
Hey, I had a kind of question / aspect to see what you guys thought of it. The way things are with the government being so corrupt lately, and we've got communist dictators running through New York now being praised by mass media. If the government was to get control of all this technology, they've sold the Americans out with everything else. I figure they'd probably want to get all involved, take control over it, and you know, dictate that. Is it possible that 90% of the reason why they're hiding all of this stuff isn't because of the American people, but because they don't want to give it to all the people going on right now in the government that are screwing everything up? And for national security, they need to just go above all that. And I also want to put in the idea that in the 70s, I don't talk much about this stuff because I don't research or anything, but in the 70s, the CIA is known for putting people on acid trips for up to a month, all documented, to get information out of them and different things. Is it the case now that maybe the CIA is not like it used to be in the 70s, and now they're our last thing between the liberals that are in government now and the people? Is it me, or is that our last checks and balance system being attacked? Thank you.
Okay.
Interesting questions there. As far as technology not being given to the government presently in power, and I'm assuming Bob was talking about the Democratic administration, because they would kind of mess things up. I don't think that's the rationale at all, that this secret technology was classified long ago for the reason that it was understood that if this technology was released, it would allow other countries such as China, India, to be able to access energy sources that would make them free of the kind of oil monopoly, and would enable them to employ most of their population, which would lead to them basically achieving in a very short time a superpower status. That we would move from a world which is kind of based on energy competition and resource scarcity to one which is based on energy abundance and kind of knowledge intensive. And countries like China and India, because of their very large populations, would very quickly become superpowers. So that was something I think these secret governments didn't want. As for the CIA being the last thing defending us, I don't think that's true at all. I think that the CIA, certainly there are a lot of very patriotic, loyal people working within the CIA, but within the CIA there are branches, and in particular the counterintelligence wing within the CIA, that has been for a long time very deeply involved in the cover-up process. As for who would be the last bulwark defending American freedom, I would say it would be the U.S. military, and in particular I'd point to the U.S. Navy as being the organization that really does take the U.S. Constitution to heart, and so I would say it would be the Navy rather than the CIA that would be the bureaucracy that would be more likely to defend America's diminishing freedoms.
All right, the telephone lines are open, 623-444-5889, or if you need to call me toll-free, 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Mark from Ohio.
Hi, Mark.
Hello, I had a couple of questions for Dr. Sala. Dr. Sala, Oscar Neumann, who is a former Livermore scientist and Project Camelot witness, has claimed that he has been on an underground base on Mars and that it is populated with both Earth and Mars humans. I wonder if you had heard this or can comment on Oscar's statement.
Yes, I have heard that, and I did meet Arthur Neumann, or Henry Deacon, as he's also known, briefly in Barcelona, Spain, where we had a chat, and he has some very interesting information. It's something that I have heard from others, that that there are these kind of jump gates or means of being able to move immediately between Earth and Mars and back and forth, that others have talked about this. Al Bulak and Preston Nichols, they also talked about that out of the Montauk project. I think such technology exists. As to how much of that Arthur Neumann was exposed to, I really can't say. I think we need to always keep in mind that people who have been exposed to those kinds of projects and have worked in those covert projects, mind control is a standard security procedure. So that means that that some of the things that such people remember may be deliberate disinformation, so that even though you might have someone who is very sincere, and I'm sure Arthur Neumann is, as is Dan Burrish, I think both come across as very sincere, that nevertheless doesn't mean that all of the information they have to say is above board, because I think mind control is something that they have been subjected to. I know Dan Burrish was subjected to that. I believe Arthur Neumann was subjected to that, just by what I saw, that he did go through some of that. So that means that we have to be very discerning and not accept everything, but just kind of like look at it all very closely and know that there may be some great truth in the things that are being relayed, but then at the same time there may be some disinformation. So we have to be always wary of that.
I have one other quick question, and I'll get off the line. Another recent Project Camelot whistleblower, Dr. Pete Peterson, claims to have studied ancient Sumerian documents that describe very clearly how to build anti-gravity craft. I wonder if you could comment on this, and I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Oh, good question. Yes, I think there's a lot of information in the ancient Sumerian cuneiform texts that the secret government has been seeking, and one of my very first research papers was about the Iraq War. I wrote that in 2003, and that looked at the Iraq War as being a cover for the covert government or the secret government going into Iraq to find these secret Stargate technologies or the texts that had information on how to build these things. So I wouldn't be at all surprised by what Pete Peterson said, that there are certain cuneiform texts that describe some advanced technologies, whether it's anti-gravity or something similar that the extraterrestrials flew at the time, that would be very important. And I think there's a very significant national security argument to be made here too, that if as some people have predicted, that Zechariah Sitchin's Planet X or Nibiru is returning into our solar system with these extraterrestrials on board, well then I think from a national security perspective, you would want to know everything you could about these extraterrestrials. And the way, best way to do that would be to go into that location on the planet where you know that they last were. So 3,600 years ago, they were active in the area of Sumeria. So, yes, the secret government would go in there and get as much as they could to prepare for the return of these beings.
Okay, we're just seconds away. Well, let's see. We got about a minute, I guess. Before our next break, let's take this flash message from Australia. This is Blue in Australia. And he says, "Hi, Mr. Kevin Smith. Will China lead the way to UFO ET disclosure? And will the USA be outdone on this matter? Secondly, a big hi to all the brave men and women in Afghanistan and around the world protecting all of us. Stay safe and come home safe. Peace, freedom, and liberty. Cheers, Blue." A good message. Okay, what about that? China going to trump us here?
I think China works very closely with the U.S., even though publicly we are aware of certain tensions. But I think that China does work closely on the economic front with the U.S., and I don't think that they would do anything that would threaten their vast holdings of U.S. currency and reserve notes, and that China would be sure not to kind of like do anything that would precipitate some kind of financial crisis with the U.S., and I think leading the way in UFO disclosure would do that.
All right. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dr. Michael Sala. We're talking about things having to do with extraterrestrial civilizations, and that is directly connected to Dr. Sala's forte, which is exopolitics. Now, Dr. Sala, you've mentioned a couple of times Stargate technology. What have you been able, if anything, to confirm related to Stargate technology or jump gates or whatever they're called?
Well, there have been a few more sources that have come forward since I first became interested in the whole question of Stargate technology, that there have been those sources that I briefly mentioned. Henry Deacon, Dan Burrish. There have been also a few others that have come forward who have talked about participating in some of these projects, such as Duncan O'Finian is another whistleblower, that he was recruited when he was very young into a project where he had to go through something like a Stargate or and on the other side, he basically found himself in what was another world, and he kind of dealt with that. So there have been just an increase in the number of individuals who have come forward and talked about what they experienced in these covert programs. So that's kind of like the main development, other than other than the kind of increase in scientific interest in the possibility of time travel, stargates, where they're able to identify that, for example, wormholes, that would be the scientific term for a stargate, that these are technically feasible, but the power that would be needed to create one of these, or the energy that would be needed, is far beyond present human technology.
But you know what? That may not be the case. When we first began with satellites, communication satellites, it was believed that they needed, you know, quite a bit of power. They transmitted, I don't mean thousands of watts, but now, you know, there are communication satellites that are, you know, like 1 watt. And as the technology advances, the power requirements can go down. It's just like this has to do with physical size rather than power. But I went through the Smithsonian Institute in, back in the 60s. And they had it must have been the late 60s, because they had the computers that ran our first space flights, Mercury space program. And these are big, tall cabinets of computers. And it would fill a room. And those computers did not have the computing power that is now in a wristwatch. And, that's physical size being reduced, but also power requirements can be reduced. And so it just may not really be necessary to have all that much power.
Well, I mean, that would be what the kind of open source literature would tell you. If you look at people like Professor Paul Davies or Michio Kaku, they would say something like a wormhole, stargate, is technically feasible, but the energy that would be required for it would take many centuries for us to reach. But of course, on the other hand, we have these whistleblowers who say that they're actually utilizing or being used in experiments or projects where these technologies are openly being used. So there's clearly a dichotomy here between what kind of open source scientists will tell us and what is happening in the covert world.
Let me read this message from Andrew in Australia. He makes a good point here. He says, if there is an ET presence on the moon and other areas in our solar system, then the ETs must know that we know of their presence. So, in your opinion, why don't the ETs just initiate contact with us?
Well, I think contact has been initiated many, many times over the last 50, 60 years, but every time it happens, the people or the authorities involved are silenced, and it's because there is a control system in place that there was a group, a highly powerful group that was created in the United States, Majestic 12, as I'm sure your listeners have probably heard, and that over the years this group that began as a kind of US-based group became a transnational group, and it is very, very powerful, and it is the one that's in control of exactly what gets out when it comes to the ET UFO issue. So yes, ETs have been making themselves known to us for many decades, but ultimately the authorities that have most power are the ones that decide what makes it into the mainstream news or not.
All right. I want to jump back to the stargates for a minute, because I just thought of something that I wanted to explore with you and failed to do so. You mentioned a connection between this topic, stargates, and going into Iraq. Now, I read your article on that. Apparently, Saddam Hussein had a group of German archaeologists working fast and furious at a site in southern Iraq right before our troops went in and took over Iraq. Right before and continuing, right before our forces went in and continuing after, there's a group, and I cannot think of the name of this group now. It's an ethnic group, and of course that is also a religious group. Starts with an M. And they lived in Sumeria. They said they are the descendants of the Sumerians. And they've been there, they say, continuously since the days of the Sumerians. Several hundred years ago, when missionaries first went through there, they saw them. And this group practices baptism. And so they thought they were Christians, but they're not. But they are colloquially referred to as St. John Christians, even though they're not Christians. Now, this group has almost vanished from Sumeria. About half of them went to Canada, and about half went to Australia. And all this happened just before, and then the process continued after the invasion of Iraq. And it was in the area where these German archaeologists were digging. And then you have written an article about one of the reasons for going into Iraq may be to recover ancient technology, Stargate technology. Do you see any connection between all of those things?
Well, the German archaeological team that was in Iraq just before the first Gulf War, that was something that was very peculiar. Because that German team knew that there was likely to be some kind of invasion there, but nevertheless they were present. They were working away on these. It was actually the tomb of Gilgamesh. They were seeking that tomb, and they actually found it. They were successful, and Gilgamesh was an ancient king of Uruk. In that area, and so and he was someone that went off in the search for immortality, and also apparently knew of the spacecraft that the Sumerians had. So he too may have had some information about some of these technologies or some of the information that he had gained. Whether it was related directly to the Stargate, we don't know. But that I think is part of the mystery of southern Iraq. All of these cuneiform texts that are buried in all of these ancient cities, and that was something that the German team, and I think there was a French team also that was involved. Various archaeological teams were very interested in excavating these. Whether that community you mentioned, whether they were in any way related to this kind of ancient repository of knowledge, it may be. Maybe that there is some connection there, but I'm only speculating on that.
One of the things that and it is purely speculation, but I've really wondered about it. I've thought about it with relationship to these people, and I wish I could remember the name of it. It starts with the letter M. Some of you listeners who remember, give me a call. Some of you are younger than me, and your mind works better. Give me a call and tell me the name of these people. I've forgotten who the name that they go by. But I've wondered if perhaps they did have some of this information and decided to vacate the area I found it to be really, really odd, Dr. Sala. These people have lived through, if they are who they say they are, they have lived through Sennacherib, they've lived through Sargon 1, 2, and 3, they've lived through Alexander the Great, through Nebuchadnezzar. I'm not getting these in chronological order. But they've lived through every conqueror that graces the pages of history, that have gone in there and conquered that area. And they've survived. They've lived, and they were surviving under Saddam Hussein. Suddenly, after all these many thousands of years, they vacate the area. And I've wondered, did they feel that, I mean, did they have the knowledge that we're talking about? Did they have that information and feel it was necessary to get it out of the country?
Well, a very, very interesting question. I think there may be just a more mundane explanation. Southern Iraq is dominated by Shiite Arabs, and they can be very fundamentalist. And I know that those peoples that have had connections to the kind of ancient cultures in that area, like I know in...
I hate to do it. We have to step away for a break. Both of our mics are just about to go dead here. All right, folks. We'll be back right after this, and we'll be on Final Approach. We'll take another call or two. Welcome back to the show. The telephone number is 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. And my guest is Dr. Michael Sala. Let's go to the telephone lines. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Stefan.
Hello, Stefan.
Dr. Sala, how likely do you think it is that governments failing to disclose that extraterrestrials will just do it to themselves in the 2012 period or beyond?
I'm not quite sure if I got your question there. Could you repeat it, please?
Sure. Do you think it's likely that extraterrestrials will disclose themselves to the world in the 2012 period or beyond that, if governments don't do it?
Yes, thank you. I think that's very, very possible. I think there has been a steady increase in UFO sightings. We've been seeing that over the last couple of years. And it's very possible that that will just increase, that there'll be more UFO sightings. And that, and from what I know, the secret government has been given a number of ultimatums that they have to disclose pretty soon. And that if they don't do it, then extraterrestrials will. So yes, I think up until the 2012 period, we may be faced very much with the situation that you've just described.
And if I could just squeeze one quick question in here also, is that do you think that a lot of the crises that we're facing today as a nation and as a world are created by this fear of disclosure by government? Do you think that governments are creating, or are a secret element within the governments are creating these crises to divert the process of disclosure?
Definitely, yes. I think that is part of the way in which they've been able to keep this all secret, is to create all of these distractions through various conflicts around the world. One of the things that I discovered in my journey from being a scholar, a peacemaker, to being an exopolitics researcher, is that initially I thought that international conflict was basically something that was dysfunctional in a functional system. In other words, that you have kind of crazy people coming up occasionally and creating havoc in the world, kind of like, say, Slobodan Milosevic in the Balkans. But then I realized, after I began to do this work, that in fact what we have is that this conflict is actually a functional aspect of a dysfunctional system. In other words, that the whole international system is created to perpetuate conflicts, and that people like Slobodan Milosevic are actually encouraged to come forward. They're like their path is smooth so that they can come forward and then create havoc, because the system relies on such people creating the opportunities and circumstances for kind of a lot of conflicts to be manufactured.
Very enlightening. Thank you, Dr. Sala, and thank you, Kevin. Great show, as usual.
Thank you. Dr. Sala, I saw a documentary on television some time back. I don't remember anything except this one thing about the documentary. The person who was speaking said the chief function of government is to wage and win war. And I thought at the time, that just sounds bizarre. But that's basically what you've just described. Let's go back to the telephone, and caller, you'll be our last call tonight. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin. Dr. Sala, it's Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
How are you doing tonight?
Good.
I hate to be a stick in the mud, but I kind of take the opposite position that our government will never release the information unless there's something that really forces them. I served in the 90s on a committee that was supposedly for that purpose, was to release information to the public. It never happened, and I don't think it's going to happen now.
Well, Mike, I think it's important to understand that there are factions within government. There are those that want to release information, and there are those that want to keep it secret. But I think what makes our present situation unique is that more of those that want to release the information are American, or that they're U.S. based, or at least that they're kind of that they are involved in. They've taken a kind of oath of office that they are loyal to the Constitution. Whereas I think the majority of those that are wanting to keep the secret belong to these transnational organizations that haven't taken an oath to the Constitution, that they are basically free agents in a way. You know, they belong to these transnational entities. And so I think what you're seeing now is that there is a steady increase in the amount of information that's being released through the internet. There are leaks all over the place. And eventually, if there's enough leaks, the boat will sink. And the kind of secrecy boat has so many leaks in it that it's quickly sinking. And so I think eventually people that are steering the boat will understand that, well, it's best to kind of like head for harbor, because if you don't, you're going to lose the boat. And so I think that's probably what's going to happen, is that eventually they'll see reason that they can't keep the ship afloat anymore. And they will decide to kind of like accept that the inevitable, that disclosure of extraterrestrial life is going to happen, and you may as well be on the winning side. No one wants to be on the losing side. Powerful people are smart enough to know when their side is going to lose, and they're very skilled at being able to jump over to the winning side and take credit for it.
Sure, and I'm on one of those on the constitutional side, and Kevin can tell you that I do everything in my power to get this information out there, and I hope that you're right, but based on what I've personally seen, I still have my doubts, and thanks for the time.
All right, thank you for the call. You know, we live in a weird time, and the reason I say it's a weird time is because in centuries past, the past really could be, you could use it to mark trends into the future. We live in a time where things are changing so rapidly and so drastically that the past is not much of an indicator about the future. And I mean, there's never been a time when China was a world superpower, economically or militarily. And I think it would be hard to argue today that they are not a superpower. Now, there are people who would say, oh, well, you know, China's not a superpower. They own everything worth owning in the United States of America. The only reason there is a functioning economy is because the Chinese have loaned us 25% of our debt. I think that sort of makes them a superpower. And there was no indicators in the past that would say either that they would be in that position or that we would be in the position we're in financially. So, you know, the way that applies to exopolitics and disclosure, I don't think we can take a look at the past and the way things have happened with disclosure in the past and really think that's a strong indicator about the future. Because, you know, the dam has cracks in it now.
Well, personally, Kevin, I would kind of lay my bet on India being the country that's going to be the disclosure country. I think that they are not as closely allied with the U.S. as China. China's kind of like...
I hate to do it, but the end is upon us here, and the music is playing. We have to back out of here. So fascinating. Dr. Sala, stay on the line with me for just a moment. And, folks, there you have it. That's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.